If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's relating to it. Everybody has seen someone like this in their lives at some point or another. If you haven't, consider yourself lucky. Before we talk about The Perfect Neighbor as a documentary, we need to strip it down to what it really is, a two-year feud that ended with a mother dead on the other side of a closed door. This wasn't a moment of passion. It was a slow burn. 2 years of complaints, phone calls, racial tension, and entitlement that finally ignited into violence on June 2nd, 2023. A mother of four, A.J. Owens, walked up to that door trying to protect her children. On the other side was a woman, Susan Lawrence, who spent years convincing herself she was under siege in her own neighborhood. The bullet that tore through that door didn't just kill A.J. Owens. It shattered the illusion of what we call neighborly. It forced the country to ask whether our idea of safety has become so warped that fear now outranks humanity. Siobhan Scott is joining us, psychotherapist and author. This is one of her books, and I have my favorite little Halloween decoration in it right now, Siobhan. You'll like that. This is Nightbird, available right now. Siobhan, before we talk about what we saw, let's talk about what this is, a long-running grievance that calcified into lethal certainty. From where you stand, I mean, what sort of mental behavioral pattern takes someone from petty complaints to firing through a closed door?
This is a fascinating case because usually in true crime, we're talking about perpetrators who we call them in the cluster B group of personality disorders. Mm-hmm. And this is someone very different who committed murder, right? But she's not typically would be looked at as a psychopath or a dramatic person who is known as a criminal. She appears to be this little old lady. So I can't say, of course, definitively what her diagnosis would be without meeting her personally. But I would sure like to know a lot about her history, because what kept coming to me over and over as I was watching it was a very different kind of personality profile. And this would be from the group called Cluster A, the odd and eccentric group. And so I would love to know her history of social relationships, the way she perceives herself in the world. My guess is that she's always been somewhat entitled and angry and carries grudges. I think if you wanted a poster person for injustice collector, this lady would fit it.
Does odd, though, I mean, there's a lot of odd people in the world. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are like this. Can you define what you mean by odd, I guess?
Yeah, odd and eccentric is simply the overarching title of Cluster A personality disorders. Of course, being odd, I'm kind of odd. You guys are kind of odd, right? Yeah, we're doing right. What we do. We're odd. So it doesn't mean that you're just unusual in that way, but it's a personality disorder. In this case, the one that came to my mind that I would certainly be looking at with her is the paranoid personality disorder. And this is a person who doesn't typically make close friends. They're very standoffish. they tend to be deeply suspicious of other people, and that may be focused around a racial group, a religious group, or it could be a complete fantasy about a political party or something like that. But it's always this sense that they're being victimized, and they stew on it and stew on it almost to the point of feeding on it. And they don't have, you know, overt delusions like believing things that couldn't possibly be true. The things they believe are generally within the realm of possibility, but it's clearly a misperception. They're seeing malevolence in benign situations. They take things very personal. And so if this is truly a person in the cluster A category, in that paranoid camp, this would be something that has been a lifelong pattern for them. And so that's why I say it would be so interesting. You know, the documentary gave us all the police footage, which was fascinating, but it would be really nice to see an interview with her where somebody went into her history and her past, because I would guess that this is a longstanding pattern with her. And before she lived in this particular neighborhood, she had issues with other people. She was clearly deeply racist. So I would guess that that's been something that's followed her throughout life, and somebody who just basically feeds on anger and keeps problems going. So when you have those qualities in someone where this has really impaired their ability to function normally, that's a sign that you're probably looking at a personality disorder like that.
Because fear is interesting here, because that's what, I mean, that's the easiest way of saying it. She was fearful of these people. But in reality, if you really break it down, what is that fear based on? It's some sort of distorted way of thinking about these people that are around her.
Exactly.
And in this given moment, it was a group of children,
yeah,
you know, playing outside. And there's, you know, it in this case specifically, they're out there playing basketball, they're playing football, they're running around, they got jump ropes. I mean, they're kids. They're kids being kids, which, number one, is a rare thing to see in society today. Mm-hmm. Children out there actively doing what a lot of us did. And rather than this woman looking out her door and going, isn't this good? Like, look, these kids are outside. They're playing. They're having fun. They're not sitting on their phones. They're not in front of a video game. They're not doing 1,000 other horrible things they might be able to do coming from an impoverished area where bad choices run rampant. These kids are being kids. And yet somehow in her mind, her cognitive distortion of reality viewed them as a threat. That's such a weird way of looking. I mean, there's one thing to be annoyed by children making noise. You know, I can get that. You know, okay, I want some peace and quiet, whatever. But at the end of the day, you have to look at what reality is here. And she clearly was not doing that because of her distorted reality, which then created fear. Let's dive into that a little bit deeper. How and why would someone twist this around in their mind to view these children playing as a threat?
Mm-hmm. That's the strange piece of this kind of thing, which is why we would say it's probably indicative of a longstanding pattern of a personality mm-hmm. disorder, because clearly they weren't a threat. I was celebrating, mm-hmm. just as you were, watching these kids playing outdoors. It's like, that's what we keep telling people, to get their kids outside and let them be normal in that way. But a person like this, and again, what causes these kinds of things? Probably genetics, probably very like some of her relatives, very much like a parent raised in a home where this was a style of thinking which reinforced the genetic tendencies. And there has probably always been an enemy in her life. And if it wasn't this group of children, it could have been who knows what, could have been anybody.
That's the interesting thing. I mean, how far back, I mean, when we're talking about a personality disorder, I mean, if you were to, and obviously we don't know, this would just be pure speculation, but if we're to look back in this woman's world, in this woman's life, are things like this rooted in trauma, or is it rooted in just upbringing, in conditioning from those around her to view the world through this prism of essentially fear that then she defines as basically anything existential that makes her uncomfortable or annoys her, basically?
I don't think we have any evidence that this kind of thing is rooted in trauma. It's not really a PTSD response because, mm-hmm. in truth, it's more about anger than it is about fear. And I think mm-hmm. saying I'm frightened just sort of becomes the excuse to be angry all the time. Because clearly in the documentary, she was baiting the kids and baiting their parents. And she was the one setting up the confrontations and the conflict. And a person like this, it's kind of like they get high off the anger and they mm-hmm. like having a fight going on. Even though she'll call the police and say, oh, I'm afraid for my life or I'm so frightened or whatever, that was just the story that she's telling that justified the rage.
I did some research on this last week, and NBC News had reported that in her court records, it said something about child abuse in her history. But again, a lot of people do have that in their history.
Yeah.
And they don't do things like this.
No. So. Child abuse, depending on how we define it, is pretty much a norm in America. You know, people do not optimally raise their children. Some kind of, you know, really unusual, severe situation may have contributed. But yeah, to just say that people abuse as children go up and murder neighbors and develop paranoia. No. Yeah, no. But yeah, we're all a product of the genetics that we get and the upbringing that we have. But the cluster A disorders, which include a few other things beside the paranoid type that I'm talking about, it is typically looked at very much rooted in genetic tendencies.
I want to understand a little bit more. The cluster A versus cluster B versus cluster C.
Yeah.
They all make a great breakfast cereal when you put them all together. A little milk on there, a little whole milk, and stir it around. A little extra sugar sometimes. I like bananas on my cluster A BCs. They're quite delicious. Cluster A, the odd eccentric versus cluster B, the more emotional, more erratic. Can you speak to that just as we can understand kind of the difference and the defining factors? And is there any crossover in some of these traits between the A's and the B's? Because I think a lot of people will look at her and go, well, she's very narcissistic. Yeah. She's, you know, and sometimes I think we hear cluster B so much, we think, well, everything's cluster B.
Everything's cluster B. Yeah. Every awful person is a narcissist now.
Yeah. Walk me through that a little bit more.
All right. Grad school lecture here. Let's see.
Yes,
how to put this into a few seconds. They have a different pattern. And cluster B, we think of those people as being very dramatic, very big in their personalities. They typically are very grandiose. So you have a bunch of different categories of them, but they're very noticeable. The cluster A folks are typically the people you don't notice, the people who are kind of in the background and strange. They're not really typically attention seeking. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a simple way to put it. The cluster B people typically don't have a lot of empathy or compassion for other people. And the cluster A person may, but only in certain situations. And if it's somebody that they're paranoid about, obviously they lose empathy and compassion for them.
Mm-hmm. So is narcissism a big piece in cluster A too, or is there a difference between the narcissist that's a cluster B versus a cluster A?
There's a lot of difference between cluster A and cluster B, but you can say that a cluster A person with paranoid personality disorder, can have cluster B tendencies and mm-hmm. some traits in a specific area. So you could have this sense of entitlement, this sort of grandiose opinion about oneself, this dramatic flair, which this lady had at times when talking to the police and painting mm-hmm. herself as such a victim. She was very dramatic. And that could be looked at as these little narcissistic tendencies. And in fact, in my book on mass killers, I talk about many, many mass shooters. The profile you see is this combination of narcissism, psychopathy, which is all cluster B, and then you throw in some paranoia from cluster A. Mm-hmm. And people with paranoia with guns are very dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I think we all have run into folks like this. I mean, it's it's I wouldn't want to say the classic get off my lawn kids type person, but it's that to an extreme. It's that when this is amped up. What made this person different than the cantankerous older person that we hear? Like, yeah, get off my lawn, kids, you know, be quiet, that sort of thing. What turned this person into something beyond that? Or are all of those types of folks basically this, but this one had access to a weapon and what, poor decision-making skills? I mean, where do you think the difference is here between just, again, there's cantankerous people all over the place, but we don't necessarily need to live in fear that they're going to shoot us.
No.
And that's, I think, a very... it's a fine line here to draw, because I think one could watch this documentary and go, oh shit, like what if, you know, what if they go do this? And it's good to be aware, but there is a difference between just kind of being, you know, a little, you know, touchy on things versus I'm going to keep going to this extreme.
Yeah, I think every neighborhood has got somebody who doesn't like kids being loud or whatever, and often it's an older person. And that's really within normal limits, normal behavior. But what I saw in the documentary was this escalating war between the woman and the parents and the kids. And again, we only saw glimpses of what was going on in the documentary, but it was alluded that this was just a consistent, chronic, escalating kind of condition. And I think that's unusual, because what I was perceiving is that this woman was feeding off it, thriving it, contributing to the escalation, and this became kind of a central organizing feature of her life. That's rare. That's a lot different than cranky grandpa down at the corner, you know. And folks who are intent on escalating this kind of a battle, calling the police out all the time, throwing things at the kids, yelling profanity at the kids, you know, all the ways that this was escalating, this is an unusual person. And I think everybody in the neighborhood, they all called her the Karen or whatever. Everybody got a sense that there was something wrong here. And I would guess that the police at some point should have been having some meetings about what's really going on here and how do we intervene in a more effective way, because this was outside the scale of typical human behavior.
She should have been behind bars and maybe in a mental institution. I mean, this behavior, there was no evidence that there was, that these kids were doing anything other than being kids. And even the police officer said, you know, they're just out there having fun. They could be out, you know, what did they say? Burglarizing things, but they're just out there having fun playing football. I mean, come on.
But I mean, how do you propose putting someone like that in a mental institution?
But
who did it do been, it? Who's complaining being, chronically?
A nuisance. Was she not a nuisance? There was nothing going on.
We don't put people who are nuisances in mental institutions.
Well, no, I get that. So I exaggerated. Sorry.
But how would something like this be handled, I guess? You know, I mean, how could have this been handled differently by those around her at the time? I mean, with the police intervention, with the kids that were out there all the time, without just completely conforming to the woman's desires and requests, just to keep her at bay, what would have been a path possibly that could have de-escalated this that wouldn't necessarily involve her making a good choice? Because, you know, she's not going to.
No.
Kids are going to be kids. Where could someone or something have intervened? Could the police have intervened in any way other than what they did? Because when we watch this, it looks like they were pretty much just following the law. I mean, I don't look at this and like the police did anything wrong. They showed up.
They kept
entertaining her.
They kept.
Yeah. I mean, they were doing what they were supposed to do. Granted, off camera, you know, or out of her, you know, earshot, that you could hear their comments of like, my God, you know, and them going to the children and saying, you know, be kids. Go do what you're going to do. You know, it's okay. And I thought, you know, this is great. But at the same time, you have the powder keg over here and you're basically telling the kids, keep playing with fire. I mean, was that a bad call on the part of the police? I mean, I totally agree with what they're saying. And the kids were in the right to be playing. But at the same point, you know, it's you know, you keep poking the thing with the stick. Mm-hmm. Eventually something bad is going to happen. It wasn't necessarily de-escalating the situation, mm-hmm. which would have, you know, probably maybe prolonged this. Or maybe this wouldn't have gone as far as it could have. How do you make somebody happy in a situation like that? Or just can you not? Does somebody have to give at some point?
What I would love to have seen happen, which of course probably in the real world, my fantasies don't ever really get to happen, but this would have been a wonderful case where you had a mental health therapist who works with the police.
Thank you.
That by the third call, the third Thank time you. A call like this came in, that person went out and in a very compassionate, kind way said, I want to sit down with this lady, Susan Lorenz. I want to sit down, Susan. And let's talk about you. Let's talk about your life. What's going on here? I was continually wondering, which is what I would ask here, why did you move to this neighborhood, right? Lots of kids
True.
Here.
Yes.
You've got racist beliefs. What is this process that's happening? And I think a mental health person could have gotten some inroads with her to possibly come up with ways to de-escalate this in some way. And again, then possibly that same person or someone else could have worked as a mediator with the parents, done more work talking with the kids, because I think at some point the kids were angry, understandably, and they did do things, you know, ring her doorbell and run and right. things like that, which just fed into the whole game that she was, in fact, I think, the one controlling it. But how to help the other people learn to cope with the fact that there's a lady who's not quite right living over here. And how do we break this up? And so that's where we can't expect the police to be mental health therapists. They're not. And mm-hmm. they get put in that position all the time of yeah. having to deal with people who are not, you know, not right in the head. There's something wrong. But we need to hire mental health people in that role to do those things. I used to work in mobile crisis where I would get called out to assist police often, but it was more just a crisis intervention to try to determine if somebody needed to go into a mental health hospital or be held for 72 hours, that kind of thing. And so I would get to go out and do some really short-term crisis intervention, which was helpful. But in a case like this, it would be lovely to have a person who had a bit more time and maybe go out and visit her periodically. You know, mm-hmm. if you did an initial assessment, maybe she needed medication. Maybe there were things that could have been done for her. I don't know. Or maybe they would have gotten a sense this lady is really, really dangerous and we need to flag her name so that she doesn't get issued a gun permit or can't purchase a gun.
I don't mean to interrupt you, Siobhan, but I think that's what I was getting at, is that it seemed like something was missing. There was a piece yeah. missing here, that it was just repeated call after call. And there's a problem with her. There's something not right with her, which we've established.
Yeah.
And look how it ended. Did it yeah. have to end this way? And Tony, I know you think I'm kind of nuts that I said, you know, she should be in a mental institution. But that's, my gut goes, something's wrong with her.
Something's
Why
wrong.
Aren't we dealing with
sure.
her?
Yeah.
And that's the, I mean, that's a big problem that we have, because, I mean, this, you talk to any police department and they got somebody that they're
yes.
showing up to calls every single day.
All the time.
And it's the same thing over and over and over. And there's nothing they seemingly can do. I mean, I completely agree, Siobhan. Like, those would be great ways of dealing with it, but we don't have it. We don't have
right.
the funding for it. We don't have
right.
the people. They don't exist. I mean, most of they it just it, and that's like a structural problem with mm-hmm. the actual system itself. The system is working as it's supposed to, but the system at the end of the day is not working, and not even optimally. It's barely getting by. It's barely surviving and barely serving the people that it's supposed to serve. So when you have something like this, it is just, okay, well, we just got to kind of keep them sufficed. And then either you, they break a law and you arrest them for some sort of minor infraction. I mean, obviously this was not a minor infraction, but in a lot of cases it is. And then, okay, then they go back and it's just the same cycle over and over and nothing can be done unless that person truly wants to get help. But they don't think anything's wrong.
No.
They think they're in the right. And this woman to this day still thinks she's in the right.
Yep.
I mean, is that, I mean, are we dealing essentially with, in a lot of ways, yes, obviously a personality disorder, but also someone who is stunted emotionally, maturity-wise, where you don't keep escalating shit with children. You don't. Mm-hmm. You don't keep going up and up and up. My kids are going to do that because they're kids, because their brains haven't been developed, because they're not mature. She seemed to be operating on almost the same sort of mental level as the children of, you do this, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? Well, I'm going to tell on you. I mean, essentially, it's telling on people because this is what she does. And then when mom actually came over, she shoots her. But it's a very archaic way of thinking, a very immature way of thinking, it seems, that she's operating under.
Yeah, this would be a person who thinks, one of my favorite terms is primitively. So yeah, childlike. Yeah. It's black and white. It's good and bad. And I'm the good guy and they're the bad guy. And that's as deep as it goes. Mm-hmm. And that's why her history would be so fascinating, because this is a person who's probably very disconnected from other human beings and does not have a rich social life or family around her, because everybody has cut ties with her because she's so odd. And
then those are the enemies. Those are the bad people.
Exactly.
They just don't understand me. That's how Siobhan Scott is with us right now. We are talking about The Perfect Neighbor, the doc that's on Netflix right now that talks about the Susan Lorenz case, where she ended up shooting her neighbor because she didn't like the sound of children playing outside and viewed her as a clear and present danger. It is an absolutely crazy story. Race is something that gets brought up very, very commonly in this case, in this story specifically. But I want to walk that back for a second and just, I guess, ask the question, does race play a huge role in this, or would this have been the same story had these kids been all white, had these kids been, you know, anything really? Is it just the fact that there was another entity, another human being or multiple human beings around her that irritated her? Was it about race in this, or was it just more about, you are making me uncomfortable, and I just want peace and quiet no matter what?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say without talking to her about her beliefs.
Sure.
If I had to make a guess, I would say that, yeah, she was probably pretty deeply racist because of the things that came out of her mouth, and she would use racial slurs at the kids.
True.
So people who have these tendencies to look for, you know, I always talk about the us and them, about, you know, us that we like or people like us, that them are the people who are different from us that we don't like. Very often it's a racial divide. And it can also go with religion or other things too. But when they perceive people as different from them, that's when you get this kind of thinking going.
And that's what I wonder about this case is, you know, obviously she went to low-hanging fruit and grabbed her very immature, childlike way of thinking of, I'm going to call names. And she grabbed a bunch of, you know, racist type ways of describing these kids. I just wonder, had they been anything else, would she have just grabbed some other names and thrown them out there too? Just because when the narcissist, this type of person, gets pushed into the corner, it's like it's an animal that's being threatened, and they're just going to react at any way, thing, low-hanging fruit that they possibly can to try and attack, you know, social acceptance be damned. That's what I wonder about this. If it was it race-based or not, or was it just that was the easiest thing for her to throw out of her mouth, that in her brain was going to be some sort of an insult at somebody, you know?
Right. Hard to know. And yeah. It would be also interesting if all those families decided to move, which I think if I lived near someone like that and I couldn't get them to move, I'd move, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. But if everyone had moved and the kids were all gone, what would she have found to be yes. angry about then? Because my guess is there would yeah. have been something else. She didn't like the way people left their trash cans out or something. You know, there'd be something to complain about.
And I want, I mean, and in the comment section, please, you know, throw your comments out there. I'm going to go to those in just a few seconds. But I want to ask this before we go to some of those is, do people like this seek out neighborhoods, seek out situations in life where they can be offended, where they can be put into this situation where they're going to be the victim? Because I do wonder, why did you choose this neighborhood? Right. Why did you, like, this was an act of choice. I mean, I grant you, the owner neighborhood, you may not necessarily know everything about it or who all your neighbors are. I don't know most of my neighbors, but you do kind of get an idea of the community you're moving into, at least if you're going to be a little bit responsible with your choices. But I do wonder if sometimes people like this purposely set themselves up, I don't want to say for failure, because, I mean, the rest of us will look at this going, well, why did you choose this? But to them, is that failure? If you get to be the center of attention and get to be the one that's spewing all this out there, to them, that's attention. That's feed. That's something that keeps their engine going when they have nothing else in life going on.
Right, right. So do they put themselves in situations where they can have a battle, they have an enemy, they have something to focus on? I think very likely they do, even mm-hmm. though they may not consciously admit it to themselves that that's what they're doing. But a person like this will find an enemy no matter where they are.
Yeah, and do they go to the sea of where there's going to be a lot of enemies? I mean, mm-hmm. People like this, would you consider her a narcissist? Let me ask you that.
I wouldn't. I don't have enough data to say that. She had some narcissistic tendencies, you know, mm-hmm. probably. But to me, she looks a lot more paranoid mm-hmm. than she does narcissistic. So, I mean, you always have to, because we're all, in truth, we're all a blend of a lot of these different things.
Sure.
And we've all got little bits of things. People can be a touch paranoid or a touch narcissistic, and that doesn't mean they have a personality disorder. It's only when it's extreme and impairs their life or causes negative consequences that you can look at it and go, okay, let's see if it meets the criteria for a full-blown disorder, and it does. So rather than seeing her as the narcissism is predominant in her life, I would say it's more this paranoid, they're out to get me. That's the predominant theme, which puts it kind of in a different category.
It's like paranoid with a purpose. Like, I'm mm-hmm. paranoid and I want to, and like, I want to be paranoid. Like, if I'm mm-hmm. not paranoid, like, she would be uncomfortable, I'm guessing, in my opinion, if she wasn't paranoid, because that's just, that's normal. That's baseline. And if the paranoia is not there, well, what the hell's going on?
Because that's her
modality.
Yeah, there has to be an enemy. There always mm-hmm. has to be an enemy. And if there isn't one, they'll create one. They'll come up with something. And mm-hmm. and you know, this is not a real common personality type. Fortunately, 1-2% of the population has this.
That's mm-hmm. it.
That's it. And again, that doesn't mean there aren't people who have a little bit of a paranoid thinking style, but they're not full blown into this kind of situation that we're talking about. But when they are, this is a dangerous person, and a person with a paranoid personality disorder should not have a firearm. They are mm-hmm. dangerous.
I mean, should there be more training? I mean, with officers, I mean, they can't be the therapists, but ways of recognizing this sort of paranoid type behavior, cognitive distortions, should there be more training, more awareness just in general of being able to recognize people with cognitive distortions and call it for what it is? It's not just this light little thing over here. It's like, you are seeing reality in a totally different way. And once you see somebody that's seeing reality in a totally different way, you start looking at all of their decision making, because it's all going through that same prism. And chances are it's very off in everything because of the way that prism is working.
Right. I think more training for law enforcement and in psychological topics and understanding these things is a really helpful thing. And that probably varies from department to department. And so I would like to think that they're getting some level of training in how to recognize it when somebody's paranoid or delusional or whatever. But I don't know. I don't know how much they get.
Recognizing is one thing, but then knowing how to act on it is another. And then also working within the rules of law and what one can and can't do is a total other. It's barrier, hoop of fire, and a lot of things that would need to change in order to truly act and to be able
to prevent. Again, I don't want to, because I know cops who are really burdened. It's a hard job. And so I would hate to put them in the seat of having to do a real mental health eval. Mm-hmm. But we certainly should be able to afford at least one mental health therapist per police department who can consult on, here's a lady who's called 12 times about a situation in her neighborhood. Let's talk about what is going on here and come up with, an intervention plan where some kind of mediator can be sent out or something like that. Because, I think cops in the field could maybe flag something, but then you'd need somebody else to come in and do some follow-up and try to head off these kind of things.
Siobhan, is there any... I'm sorry, Tony.
No, go ahead.
Is there anything that this neighborhood could have done to maybe look and have some meetings and go, all right, the lady's nuts. Here's what we need to do. And could they have done an intervention of their own? And instead of her being isolated in her paranoia, could they have maybe brought her out for, some snacks? Here's some Triscuits. Come, come watch our football game. Come see us. Come see that we are just having fun. Could that have changed the outcome in any way?
That's a hard one. My thought watching it was if I was the mother across the street and my kids were playing and this crazy woman who everybody knew was weird was there and was so hostile, I would simply remove my kids. I mean, I'd probably try to move out of the neighborhood, but I would say, don't play in that field. I know you have permission to play in that field. It's not right. But I would note the red flag that this lady is kind of scary and these things are escalating. So I would remove the kids just out of safety. And so would it have made any difference? Who knows? But I would hate to put the burden on the families that, this woman is crazy and taunting your kids and behaving erratically. And now you guys have to intervene in some way. I mean, would it have made a difference? Maybe. I don't know.
I mean, my other thing, Bob Defense Diaries had made a comment here, too, of he thought the officers were relatively effective in dealing with the kids. I thought they were too.
They were great with the kids.
I guess the question is, did anyone realistically see this coming? I mean, I don't know that they did. I mean, it was at the end, the very, very, when she pulled the trigger, she was out there waving the gun allegedly at those very last moments. But leading up to that, she was a cantankerous old bitch. And that was kind of it. I mean, complaining, calling the police, but she wasn't out there cocking the shotgun on the porch every day. I don't know. I mean, you tell me, were the signs there that this woman is going to escalate to that level? It seemed to go from, 0 to 1,000 very quick. And when we're kind of averaging about 100 on a daily basis, it just went, way out really fast. I don't know. I mean, I if I were a police officer, from what we saw in that, I don't know that I'm going to think this woman's going to shoot somebody. I'm going to think I'm going to keep getting more calls and bitching from her. But were there the signs? Were the signs there that she was going to do this?
Apparently not. I don't know if I can't remember if in the documentary if they said anybody was aware that she had a gun. Did she say that at some point?
I don't know. But I mean, again, even if you knew she had a gun, I mean, at this day and age, I mean, I kind of assume most people probably have a weapon of some sort in their home. But even so, I don't know that I'm going to think that this woman's going to go shoot at somebody. She seemed off, but she didn't seem that type of off, I think. I mean, at least that would be my perception on it. I mean, the mother felt safe enough that I'm going to go knock on the door. I mean, yeah. Why are you doing this? I don't think anybody thought that, didn't perceive her as that level of a threat. And that's what I'm wondering about. If nobody's perceiving this as that level of a threat, should they have? I don't know that anyone naturally would.
I think we all have to, unfortunately, mm-hmm. because there have been so many incidents of particularly Black kids or Black young people going up and knocking on the door of an elderly white person, and just because they're lost or they're looking for directions, and they get shot at the front mm-hmm. door. And some of those cases have been in Florida. So I think, unfortunately, if I hope we're not living in a country where every single person is armed and ready to shoot through the door when their doorbell rings. But we almost have to have that caution in mind, because this is just one of those cases where I think that Susan Lorenz certainly had been thinking about it because of her internet searches and the things she was looking up about stand your ground laws.
Yeah.
So I think you can really look at it that she had this intent for some time, and in essence, at least unconsciously, was setting this confrontation up.
Yeah. I mean, in her mind, I'm guessing it was probably justified of what do I do if I have to? If I'm in this situation, how is this going to work? I'm going to guess that's probably how her mind was talking to her. And then you're in that situation. And then she perceived this threat. I mean, I'm guessing she didn't necessarily think, you know, this is going to be a great day to go shoot my neighbor. But would you agree that she genuinely thought there was a life and death threat at that moment in time? No matter, I mean, completely cognitively distorted, because there wasn't, but in her brain, did she think there was an actual threat, or was this something else that was taking over?
I think the fantasy of retribution and shooting someone, the fantasy had probably been going on in her head for a long time. And she probably, in this fantasy, visualized that she would come out as the hero victim in a way, that look mm-hmm. what this poor woman had to do to defend herself. But she got a great deal of satisfaction, this is very twisted, out of the fantasy, out of thinking about it, which is why she set this drama up. So she really wasn't a victim here. She was the perpetrator.
Yeah. Let's go. Stacey, what are we looking at in the comments right now? What are some of the questions that are being asked?
Well, a lot of people have asked about the gun. One other thing that Bob Mata just put up from the Defense Diaries podcast. The question I have is, why didn't her attorney employ a mental defect defense? I think that's a really good question. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, Siobhan, you coming from a psychological aspect of this, would that be a reasonable defense for her?
I think it would be about the only thing you'd have. And again, not knowing her history, I don't know how much evidence you'd have for it. There could have been a lot of evidence that she had a history of erratic, hostile, bizarre behavior, and try to make a mental health condition as a defense. But from what I know about, you know, trying to get off with an insanity plea, you have to be really psychotic. Mm-hmm. And this kind of person is not psychotic. You know, they're not believing things that can't possibly be true. The things that stories that they're telling themselves feasibly could be true. So it doesn't really meet the bar for an insanity defense most of the time.
Wow. It feels like it, though. I mean,
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, there's a difference here, too, of choosing to believe your delusions. I mean, there is some autonomy here as well. I mean, there's a difference between where your mind, like, this is it. This is black and white. This is how it is. I truly think that there's, you know, a demon at the door, you know, literally. I mean, if you're thinking the devil is outside your door and they're coming to get you, that's clearly you're nuts. There's mm-hmm. something right. mentally wrong. And right. and there's a difference between that and then it's my neighbor. I just threw a roller skate at a kid. Mom might be mad. Like mm-hmm. that you're making a choice to dig yourself deeper into that mm-hmm. hole of delusion.
Right. Right.
And that's I think is that a good way of describing kind of the difference
really good
here in that way of thinking?
Really good way to describe it. Yeah, a truly delusional person has no control over the fantasy life, and they can't. In fact, they can't tell what's real and what isn't real at all. Versus personality disorder, they're looking through a filter and they're distorting reality, but it doesn't meet the standard of being delusional.
What else we got out there?
Shana, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing it, says she was abusing the police department. She could have faced charges for that, I would think. I think that was, I had made reference to that as well. Think of all the other calls that maybe were not getting attention because they were dealing with her so much. I just wonder if that was something that was overlooked by the department, that maybe we need to, like, again, with the mental health aspect, maybe somebody else should have been dealing with her so they could go deal with calls out on the street. So that was one comment that was in there. Also, people had brought, somebody did bring up, she told them the N-word a bunch of times. Again, that racist aspect.
Yeah.
And a lot of talk about not being stable enough to have a gun. But again, if she was undiagnosed, she has a right to own a gun.
And even in this country, even diagnosed, I mean, there's nothing that says a person, even if she had a diagnosis of flaming paranoid personality disorder, that's not a mental illness that's going to keep her from getting a gun in the United States.
But again, that stat that you said as we first began, people with this kind of disorder, and again, we are just, you know, going off of the documentary, we don't have a diagnosis for her. That turns them into a very dangerous person when they have a gun.
It does. We have a lot of very, very dangerous people with guns.
Yes.
And if people think that we're doing any kind of mental health screening to keep the mentally ill from having guns, we're not, folks. We're not. There's a lot of mentally ill people with guns.
Go walk around a gun show for a day.
Oh, God. Like,
wouldn't it be great? I would love this. I would love if to enter the gun show, you have to go through a mental health screening.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
Could you imagine? Could you imagine? No one would be there.
I went to one once in this area, Tony.
I've been to several.
Area.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm a gun owner. I have, there
yeah,
are.
Yeah, I am too.
I've got three guns with me, right? No, two. I'm sorry. Two.
Two are under the table right now.
No. They're not. They are not loaded. They are in a gun safe.
Yeah.
But I felt very uncomfortable at the gun show.
Yeah.
And I'm a gun advocate that you need to be trained and practiced on a regular basis so that you're proficient. And I felt uncomfortable at the gun show. So there's an element. I'm just casting a blanket over it, but there's something different. I'm going to say different.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a way to get guns and bypass the system in a lot of states, too, where you don't have to. There's lack of screening. There's all that go on. And there's certainly normal, healthy way. I'm not saying everyone that goes to the gun show is bad. I've been to them myself. I am a gun owner, too. But there is a sect of the folks there that shouldn't be having weaponry. And you know it right away. I mean, and they tend to be around the paranoid book clubs.
I was gonna say the paranoid people and the people who are waiting for or advocating for race wars.
Yes.
So
yeah.
you get a very distinct kind of person.
And that's Tony. That's the feeling that I was picking up on. Was like, whoa, dude? What, you know? Just this look of boy. My spidey senses up. You know.
As with everything in our country, though, it's we're not proactive, we're reactive. Mm-hmm. And then horrible shit happens. How did this happen? Well, there's a recipe. Here's the recipe on how this happened. I don't know how to fix it. I don't think anyone really does, other than we do some more common sense things. And I'm not even talking about guns. I'm just talking about mental health in general, of when you recognize that there's something really off on someone, it feels that, you know, our system is basically, well, let's hope it goes away. let's just, we'll keep doing our job, keep following the system and hope maybe they'll get better. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll do something horrible to themselves or others, and then we can react. But that's, and then you get situations like this, and the mom of four is dead because someone was afraid of their own shadow, basically. It's a screwed up story.
Before you continue on, Tony, one more comment from The Last 24. Great coverage on the side of what causes the criminal to move the way they do isn't covered enough, in my opinion. So thank you for that, The Last 24. You've had some great comments.
Yeah. And Bob, yes, I agree. You probably should buy one at this point. I do. I wish I didn't have to own one. I was not a gun owner until probably about 10 years ago. And I just felt I got one when I had a kid. And I'm like, I would be neglectful if I didn't have something in my home in case something were to happen. And it's locked up. It's safe. There's no way in hell she could get her hands on it, any of that. And, you know, being responsible, there's nothing wrong with that. But just, I don't know. I don't think it's being paranoid in society to recognize that there are monsters out there that are unhinged, and it's not a bad idea to protect yourself or have the means to, should you need it. Will I likely ever use it? Probably not. Is it probably some version of a safety blanket? Probably. But I don't know. Weren't you teasing me
for having knives all over my apartment?
That I will. And that's not safe. I don't have any kids.
I have cats.
The cats, you never know. Cats can become ninjas too. I mean, have you seen the sequel to Milo and Otis? You know,
I have not.
Oh my God, it's dark. They got rid of it. It's not on, you can't find it anywhere because Milo and Otis become gangbangers and they end up taking out like a whole shopping mall. It was a really dark Disney movie in 1994.
It's a good thing you're a couple states away, dude.
Cats can do weird shit.
My cats, if they pick up my knives, there's a lot more going on than just...
The point there is you could be easily overpowered with that.
I'm in martial arts and I'm training to use those knives.
That doesn't matter. If someone wanted to overpower you, they could.
Well, they could if I had a gun, too.
You have a little more leeway there with a gun, I think, than with being ninja knife warrior. And again, the cats. Think of the cats. The cats, you know... They don't
we'll
have opposable thumbs,
the
but they know how to use those paws. They can, you know.
They're armed as well, so.
All right, let's wrap it up there. Meow, as someone says. All right. Siobhan, as always, thank you for coming on and giving us your thoughts. Nightbird is your memoir and The Minds of Mass Killers. It's right over here in my library pile of books. Also available wherever books are sold. All right. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Stacy, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.